Gleich geht's los mit dem On the Way to New Work Podcast. Einen kurzen Moment Geduld, denn ihr werdet sehr viel Zeit sparen und Geld bekommen. Es geht nämlich um eure Steuererklärung. Ich weiß nicht, wem von euch das ähnlich geht, aber ich tue mich damit immer sehr schwer. Ich habe aber auch die Möglichkeit, das abzugeben. Die hat aber nicht jeder. Und dafür gibt es jetzt eine Lösung, nämlich die Firma smartsteuer.de. Smartsteuer digitalisiert den analogsten Prozess Deutschlands, nämlich die Steuererklärung. Und in 20 Minuten bekommt ihr durchschnittlich 1069 Euro Steuern erstattet. Insgesamt hat Smartsteuer schon über 700 Millionen Euro an Kunden erstattet bekommen. Denkt einfach mal dran, dass wir in Deutschland fast eine halbe Milliarde verschenken jedes Jahr, weil wir das nicht machen. Und wer es jetzt wirklich eilig hat, für den hat eben Smartsteuer eine App. Die nennt sich Smartsteuer Express, geschrieben Xpress, in den Stores von Apple und Google. Ladet die mal runter. Ihr könnt direkt bei der Eingabe sehen, wie viel ihr wahrscheinlich zurückbekommt. Ziemlich cool. Einfach mal runterladen und jetzt viel Spaß mit der neuen Folge.
Herzlich willkommen zum On the Way to New Work Podcast. Ich bin heute ohne Christoph Magnussen in Berlin bei meinem sehr geschätzten Freund Max Giordani. Du bist der Größte für mich. Du bist Mr. International, du bist Mr. Inspiration. Ich habe durch dich viele spannende Leute kennengelernt und du hast jetzt heute den Podcast Takeover, weil Christoph nicht dabei ist. Und erklär mal kurz, wo wir hier sind.
Ah, danke, zu viel der Ehre. Also wir sind hier in Berlin bei Create und wir sind eine Innovationsberatung. Wir hatten eben das Vergnügen, die SY-Partners aus New York zu haben und wir hatten gerade einen sehr spannenden Dialog und Discussion mit so ein paar sehr, sehr spannenden Leuten und ich war mega happy.
Genau, das war ich auch. Also für alle Hörerinnen und Hörer, die uns kennen, das ist also nicht unser Gast, sondern Max vertritt Christoph und unsere beiden Gäste sind Mark und Thomas from SY Partners in New York. We're happy to have you.
Happy to be here.
Good to be here.
And you both have some roots, at least in the German language. Maybe you explain your roots and maybe you explain for us what led you to us here. How was your way through your career? Because we learned already your fascinating stories, but our listeners would love to do it as well. Mark, will you start?
Yes, of course. So, you know, it's funny. I grew up in a very, very international environment. You know, mein Vater kommt aus Deutschland, so ja. Ich kann Deutsch reden, aber ich bin nicht super fließend. So, Englisch ist ein bisschen mehr bequem. Meine Mutter kommt aus Portugal. So, you know, I have these two different kind of European backgrounds conflicting, but born in New York. And so, you know, through that lens, kind of, I've always been exposed to many different cultures. And I've always had this hunger to really see the world in different ways and understand different perspectives. And really informed, I think it's a lot of what I bring to our work, which I'll explain later. You know, after work, you know, it's funny, actually, a lot of people don't know this. I actually went to university for 1 year in Freiburg.
Wow.
In the Schwarzwald. Yeah, yeah.
It's a famous university.
Albert Ludwig's one.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's well, where I studied it's as well.
Famous. Did you really?
Yes.
Oh, man, that's really? Funny.
Yeah, but also for 1 year.
Well, Max, you'll love this because, you know, I you know, was a precocious college student, deeply in love with Western philosophy. And I said, you know, I have to go to the house of Heidegger and I'm going to, like, learn in philosophy in German, etc. And, of course, aspiration met reality pretty quickly because as soon as they started attending class in philosophy, it's like, holy shit, I don't understand anything. So I quickly switched to Deutsch als Fremdsprache for a little bit. But afterwards, I think just briefly on career-wise, funny enough, I started my career at Bertelsmann, but in New York.
Random House? Or
at Random House, yeah.
Times Square.
Yeah, in that Times Square building, that's true.
Markus Stohle was the CEO or was it his name?
God, I can't remember his name now, yeah. Nonetheless, it's quite a cool story because actually the very, very first book I worked on was The Da Vinci Code.
Wow.
You might have heard of it.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it was quite an amazing experience to launch that. And, you know, I was just young and in the publicity department, and a lot of people don't remember that. That book was launched the day the U.S. invaded Iraq. So we had imagine two different strong news cycle to get out and penetrate, but you know, that book had legs, to say the least. And I think it provided a nice alternative from the everyday environment in the US. But after publishing, you know, after especially that book, you realize it's not going to get any better than that. And you can see also the writing on the wall in terms of where the publishing industry was going. You saw some dark days ahead. And I switched to film for a little bit in New York, the New York film scene. And it's funny, actually, was one of the many, many people who worked on the film Moneyball. You might have seen it with...
I love Moneyball. It's amazing.
Such a great film. Yeah. It's gone through many, many iterations. So it's it was a big hit, actually. It was fun. But I was my career was very much a result of... it's called stunted, my film career, by really the advance of technology. And in New York, suddenly having a film studio and office out in New York really didn't make a lot of sense. So everyone was moving to LA. And I chose not to do that. I chose a different path. I moved quickly to lived in Shanghai for a few years, an advertising agency.
Which one was it?
It's called Global Sources. Mm-hmm. It's a really funny kind of thing. They just help... do advertisements for Chinese companies, manufacturing factories. So it's just something you can talk yourself into when you're living in Shanghai. Factories who want to manufacture jeans for Diesel and this kind of thing. You know, but afterwards, you know, it's a great cultural experience. You learn a lot, actually, navigating both the German companies, the American kind of companies, and the Chinese in Shanghai. And I went to business school in Asade in Spain, Barcelona.
Wow.
And then afterwards, was thinking about coming back to Europe. But I stumbled upon SY Partners. And I couldn't believe that such a place existed. And that the challenge and the art of working with big global organizations and, you know, helping architect the transformation through a human lens, especially with so many different cultures at play, was just fascinating to me.
Thomas.
Yeah, so I'll start with a common thing. I think Mark and I are, we both have German blood, roots. And I also grew up in an international context in Vienna with a German father, a Hungarian mother. I think that these differences and the international schooling and context that was sort of the formative years of my growing up, we're all about really differences, and the reconciliation of apparent paradoxes and things that were unresolvable because they were just different. And yet, I think back in sort of middle age to what were the beginnings and what was the pursuit that began to happen actually at a very early age for me. It was actually about the universality of things. So as I was growing up in a very diverse, both language, culture, provenance world, I became very early, very interested in what is universal to humans, and what is the thing we all have in common, what are the things we all have in common, and also what are the nonverbal languages that we all understand.
Mm-hmm.
And music is one of them. But I didn't pursue music, or did not go into, being a musician. But what I understood was to be another language that became essentially what guided my whole life so far, at least my professional life, but also beyond my artistic practice, is beauty. Beauty is universal and often misconstrued as something that is superficial, something that is pleasurable and delightful. I would argue and beg to differ that beauty is the full spectrum of the human experience, expressing itself sometimes in verbal and intellectual ways, but also very often in emotional, visual, experiential, tangible, palpable ways. And I found myself, and this is really, I think, the epiphany as I think back, is that my obsession with the power, the overwhelming power of beauty, really evolved in early museum visits, when my parents sometimes dragged me, sometimes encouraged me, and sometimes I willingly came along to go really at a regular basis to see paintings, photographs, sculptures. And I do remember very vividly spending extortionate amounts of time, also later in my art school years, just looking at one painting for a very, very, very long time.
How old were you at this time when you started to?
My chronology is weird. I'm not sure, but I would say that probably between the age of 8 and 12, that really started to develop. The looking and the sensing of the overwhelmingness, and also of nature. So I spent a lot of time in nature. As a cyclist, when I was young, my dad took us out, and the ability to sit with something that is overwhelming and non-verbal and non-intellectual, and it was something that formed my pursuit, my interest in this universal language, the power, the conviction that sits in beauty, the ability to convey powerful messages and move people to do things, not just move people to feel things, but then also move people to do things. And of course, there was then a long set of experiences that eventually led me to where I am today, where this is fundamentally relevant. And I'm sure we're going to talk about this more. But I guess one interesting, I won't talk about everything, but I'll talk just about, one station, which I think in some ways is interesting, is that I actually went through art school not being aware of what I'm telling you right now. And it's only in the last year that I understood why I was there. I mean, the only good justification I had for being at art school was that I didn't want to go to any other kind of school. And that's actually a reason why a lot of people end up at art school.
Love this story.
Right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people end up at art school because they don't want to do law, they don't want to do business, they don't want to do this. So I ended up there. I didn't know what I was doing there. I did a lot of fun stuff. But I didn't learn any graphic design or any of the stuff I was supposed to learn there. I was not learning. I was gravitating hugely towards my liberal art teachers, because that is where I was starting to engage with the higher theory and the understanding of universal languages. And it was a communication degree. But actually, the big epiphany was a visit by Oliviero Toscani from Benetton in our office, in our school. And it was the penny drop moment for me. And this was an early discovery for me that the medium of the magazine is a wonderful synthesis of meaning and feeling, and language, words, and image. And in the pre-digital era in which this moment happened, I realized this was my medium, that there was something about the omnipresence of a magazine in people's households, the fact that it was ubiquitous, that it would get mass-produced, and people could read it and sit with it and see it and feel it, and Colors being a very visual magazine as well, and a very beautiful magazine. People would argue it isn't, but it's exactly that. It goes deep to the core in some ways. So I actually worked with Colors after that. And then, interestingly, I won't go through the entire story, but I ended up at Condé Nast, at German Vogue, as my first real designer job. And interestingly, it jarred with so many aspects of my value system, but it was the home of beauty. It was the home of a certain kind of beauty, but it was the home of where beauty is being made at a very, very high level. And it took some encouragement from people more experienced than me to remind me that even if I hated a lot about it, this is the place where you'd start to understand how you make beauty. How you use beauty is up to the maker. But and so I actually spent a long time with Condé Nast, with some other stints to other places, but it's actually where I understood that as a designer, we own that space to some degree, and we have the ability to bring head and heart, into fusion. We can take intellectual constructs and make them emotionally powerful, relevant. We can move people to do things and feel things, because we can use universal languages like image, like color, to create powerful effect. And this was still all pre-digital age, which is very interesting, because had I known what was going to be possible then, it would have already been a richer experience. And so anyway, to cut a long story short, I've always been pursuing that universality. It's the thing I'm most preoccupied with. It doesn't mean I don't engage with words. Of course I do, and I love them. But I'm very focused on understanding what we have in common and what we commonly respond to, and where the bridges happen in our disagreements, and where the connection happens between what we want and who we are, and where the connections are between what other people want us to do and what we want to do, which is really the heart of culture. When the moment of authenticity happens, where I have had a moment of insight that connects me through my personal experience with what I'm asked to do by someone who sits outside of myself, an employer, a parent, whatever it might be, And that's really the work we do every day in some way. And so
we come to this later, but Max, maybe you, just you explain how do you meet these guys?
Oh yeah, I'm happy to do so. But just a very quick follow-up question: how much of your day job is actually design, and how much is words? So how many times Photoshop is still open for you? Or? Yeah,
I love that question. And to answer it in the context of my SY partners, it's very, very diverse. I would argue that every project demands a slightly different pie chart of how much. I just think it's really very indistinguishable. I mean, I think you have to be able to create beauty with words and sense with words, and it will always matter because it's one level at which we take in complex ideas, also simple ideas. So I find myself writing all the time, actually, all the time, every day, in small and big ways. But I also find myself designing a lot, not just by way of others, but also by myself. Maybe more in a gestural and you know, to capture the essence of something. I think I'm more in that mode than in, you know, end-to-end execution mode. But I spend very little time just walking around, you know, criticizing stuff. That's thankfully not my job, and it's also not something that we.
You supercharge really, stuff.
It's not something, right? I supercharge stuff, but I also have to demonstrate what we call proof of concept. If I say something, I endeavor in the best of days to show what I mean.
Thomas is one of my favorite people in the office because I think he embodies something we always talk about, which is fusion. You know, this idea of creativity and systems thinking, and you know, you wear so many different hats. I can pull on him to write something beautiful or punch up some copy to help shape a design or an experience. And I think that's you really embody that.
You called it in your little speech head and heart. That's what I remember. You really tried to bring this together in the work with SOI partners. Is it right?
Yeah, and I think it's also the head is the safer place to take. I mean, please argue with me, Mark.
No.
The head, the rational construction of an ambition or of a strategy is the safer place for people to engage because it's there, it's measurable, it's evidential. I think
it's logical.
It's logical. There is sense, cause and consequence.
You know?
The hard part is the bit that requires an opening of the gateways between my outside world and my inside world, my lived experience, my sensibilities, my insecurities, my hopes, my dreams, my fears, all that stuff, which is really, I mean, you know, it's a little bit of a silly distinction, the heart and head thing, but I think what we mean when we say that we have to always move people from the head to the heart and back, and it's a dialogue box. It's not a binary. It's a one thing. Is that the change, personal change, is what then creates organizational change or any change has to happen in that dialogue. Then it will happen. Then you will do something. Otherwise, you won't do something over and over again.
The perfect bridge to what SY Partners is offering and doing. So we're starting with change and transformation. Maybe you explain the company you're working for. I think it's a fascinating story, and then we go deeper into it.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I was sharing earlier this morning that April 1st, funny enough, April Fool's Day in the U.S.
So it's the same with us.
Oh, is it really? Okay, good. Good to know. Well, it's just Monday. We passed a remarkable milestone for SY Partners. We turned 25 years old.
That's the perfect timing. Thanks, Mark.
If I would have known.
Where's our party?
my new company had a second birthday on April 1st.
It's a good day.
Forget it. Yeah, exactly. That's funny. That's
currently a good date.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's my partners now.
Yeah, so, you know, I think born really in Silicon Valley with real roots and DNA in Apple is kind of the real headline. And, you know, the S and the Y, it's quite a cool story. So the S stands for Robert Stone, who's a big designer in Apple in the 80s. And the Y for our founder, and still very much with the firm, Keith Yamashita. And you know, a lot of our DNA, and a number of the people who work, even our current CEO Susan Schumann, also they all know found each other in Apple in the 80s, at the height of kind of Steve Jobs launching the Macintosh, changing the world. They all actually, funny enough, worked on the Newton. So I used to joke, there are two great things that came out of that project versus the kind of platform for the iPhone, and the other is SY Partners, in a way.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting. So, you know, Robert was a terrific designer, no doubt. But Keith, you know, at a remarkably young age, found himself becoming one of Steve Jobs' head writers. And you know, it's really interesting because that intersection, that relationship, this marriage of design and great storytelling and communications are really almost the heart of what we start out with and do, and very much in our DNA. You know, they followed Steve to Next when he had left Apple for the first time. And when right around the same time when Steve went back to return to the helm of Apple, you know, he took a lot of that Next platform to become what would then be the next generation of the Macintosh. Robert and Keith started creating this firm, SY Partners. And I would say for the first 5 years, we were, I'd say, a premier communications firm, really marrying design, great storytelling, comms, creating, you know, beautiful, it's funny, like some of our earlier work, if you would look at it, you know, it's what you would expect. Reports, annual reports, this kind of thing. But, you know, through the art of inquisition and asking brilliant questions and the art of that, I think we really fell into what we are now, which is a transformation company. Really getting at the why and the heart of what needs to change and why, and helping CEOs and their leadership teams really architect their transformation. And getting first really clear on a purpose, the why, et cetera, and finding out and then compelling that vision that's really worth fighting for. And I think that's the key piece, worth fighting for is the hard part.
Yeah. I mean, just to put it into timely perspective, when you mention it's 25 years old, I mean, you're just describing, I mean, the heydays of the first wave of the internet, of the new economy, I mean, until the year 2000. So. Was it already like called transformation? I'm just curious because it just became such a huge topic, or was it back then just figuring out how to make a change, or how do we deal with this new medium, or what's, you know, ahead of us?
It's funny. I think, you know, we saw the signals of transformation. I mean, now it's the ultimate buzzword, right? Everyone is offering transformation, from digital transformation, people transformation, blah, blah, blah. You know, we had a hard time, I think, articulating what we did initially, because we were often asked to do so many different things, from creating great stories to mobilizing people. And then when we started to really piece it together, I think was, I would say, only mid-2000s did we start to call ourselves and decide to own the idea of transformation. Beforehand, I think we used to say we had helped like great leaders build great companies, and, you know, we're which is more tagline versus an actual idea that you wanted to own.
I think there's something I want to add to the, you know, little bit of color to what I think is compelling about the origin story is that, well, one thing that, you know, I've, you know, have spoken to our founder many times about, and that I've, you know, we have said many times, is that the act of leading a company is an act of design, that a CEO is actually a designer. A designer of a system of impact, a designer of an idea-driven manifestation in the world, and the leadership of an organization is a constant act of design. And I think this is a very important. It's certainly something that guides how I go into the work, is to understand design in its widest context. So not just as executional, as graphic design or experience design, but organizational design, the design of how an idea becomes real. And that guides really our a lot of what we do. I think that's one.
I think so you very often start with the CEO. Huh? You're not
right.
Talking to the communication director, the marketer. You start with the CEO.
Right.
I don't want to interrupt you.
So. Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. And it sort of makes sense to talk to the chief designer about the design of the system. Which doesn't mean everybody else isn't fully integral and important in the process. And then the other thing I would just say that I think matters in the conception story is that the value of beauty and experience and, of course, function and sense is core to why an Apple product is the experience that it is and is the ecosystem that it is and open-ended and evolving. And I think a lot of that poured into the founding idea of why we're actually a mashup of thinkers and makers and provocateurs and the executors, because all of it matters in the there's not such a thing as a complete or perfect thing, but it matters when it is designed with all that mastery in mind. And I think that's another thing that I think is still true. You know, we have a design department, even though I don't like to put a fence around it, because I think it's actually a fluid entity that is part of how we work. But, you know, I think one key thing to know is that we don't see design as a capability that we bolt onto a strategy endeavor. We see design as an integral part of how we do our work. So it's very different than, you know,
a typical thing.
Buying a design agency and saying we have design as part of our offering. We don't sell design. We are design. We do design.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting is that IDEO is a sister company of you, and mm-hmm. you explained during this breakfast today the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can do this again, because I think it's a fascinating
topic. I mean, I would caution us, and I caution myself readily, to be careful not to go into binaries, because I think that we have a lot in common as well.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've learned, and not only IDEO, I think there are other companies that help clients with innovation and change, you know, large management consultancies, et cetera, and one thing that I have learned through collaborating with them at times, but also just through understanding and talking to clients about their experience in this different realm, is that there is a design process, and I want to keep it at a level where we don't pick it apart, but there is a design process that is heavily informed by the need state in the outside mm-hmm. world, by developments and trends in the world, in the market, in the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And where a lot of emphasis is put on the feedback and opinion of the end user or of the person who intersects with a service or with an organization. And again, I want to make sure we don't make a binary here, because I think both matter at all times, for sure. But I think there's a question of weighting. I think there's the other end of the spectrum, which is stuff that you're thinking about a product, a service, an organization more from the source of, like, what is an organization uniquely gifted at offering the world? What is its distinctive DNA? What is its kind of source code? What is it? What is its founding? What is it in the founding story that is the thing that will always inform what happens? And not asking the world for permission, not looking for the answer in the world, but looking for the answer inside. And I'm not saying that we only think that way.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is that our waiting, and it goes back to the Apple DNA as well, like, you know,
I want to put a thing into the universe.
I want to put something into the world that the world does not yet know it wants.
That's right.
And I think that's important, mm-hmm. because it actually has an impact on how we work and the methods. I mean, we don't really have methods,
soul sisters in a way. You know, we're constantly fascinated with each other. You know, and as a matter of fact, I mean, both of you have visited our offices. We share an office in New York, in a way. You know, and IDEO, of course, you know, the notion of design thinking has now become really how so many, the standard in many ways of how great creative teams work and partner together. And I think, you know, and obviously they're more focused, I think, on innovation and product design and not just place it there. You know, we're obviously very much at the CEO transformational level, but we often just borrow each other's capabilities left and right.
I mean, it's not the other is better than the other. Totally understood that. So what you're basically saying, one way to approach this is from an outside-in perspective, using the help of design thinking, to basically have a process that leads to result. And what SY partner stands for is really changing from the inside, like really working from the inside out. And So it's not, it's just like two different approaches. But just to be, I just want to clarify, did I understood correctly? You said you don't have methods?
I don't want to put you on the spot here, Marcus.
Yeah, no, but you know, okay, we could, you know, we could go into a whole conversation about what is a method, but it's, I think we have beliefs and we have, and I think we you know, we have guiding, a guiding worldview about change and how it happens and that it involves people and that it is led by people and that everybody needs to own the change and that that is a process of empathy and generosity of an organization to get to a place where people are the change and want to be the change. So I think this, but this feels not like a method, but more like a belief. And I also think that we think of systems as being key to how we look at a problem and how we work with a client. Systems meaning everything from the tiniest detail to the highest, most, you know, 10,000 feet soaring aspiration, and everything in between has to be accounted for when transformation is designed. But again, I don't see that as a method. I see that more as a consideration and a belief that guides that you can't do transformation unless you look powers of 10, you know.
It's a funny guiding principle too, because, you know, I think it almost feels maddening at times often because we often get asked to solve, you know, similar problems from CEOs, but we ask our teams to, they might solve them in radically different ways, but using the principles and beliefs that we hold. And I think that's what keeps us sharp and creative, and you, that's why you see so many different manifestations of our work and response to a problem. And, you know, that's why our work looks so different. There's not a template that we return to or anything, you know. We love to almost solve the problem from scratch, for better or worse, in the best way that we know how.
Because the reason why I'm asking is because Michael and I had the pleasure to just look at your work. You brought over a lot of physical, amazing stuff, and there is so much passion for detail. So, but I fully understand it's not like you don't have the same principle all over for the same client, for different clients, the same methodology. It's right. More about having a belief system, a framework, and then you choose the right tools, because the output, and I think both Michael and I were so blown away. It's stunning. It's like both visually, but also intellectually, strategically, like very well articulated stuff that you can put on a wall. Maybe you can describe like one of these outputs, like what's, We've seen like a framework for strategy or something.
So you might be referring, you know, I'd say one of our most iconic bits of IP, you know, and I lead kind of business development now. It feels globally now for the firm. And I used to joke we should just replace our website with this image. You know, if you want to learn more, click, because people find it is so clarifying. And what it is... simple transformation agenda and what it codifies, and there's so much work that goes into this, but it's almost an articulation of a strategy on a page that really breaks down like a high level ambition, marries together purpose, a vision, what we call the bold moves, the big grand strategic gestures required to get there, a breakdown of then you know, what you're doing now between now and the next, let's say, 18 months, you know, to build a sense of urgency, and of course how you'll measure success. And, you know, the work and effort to create this, and it's just brings radical clarity to often situations that feel so overwhelming and complex. It becomes kind of the blueprint for change. And, you know, we create this for a lot of our clients, especially, you know, big global organizations that we've been lucky enough to partner with, the Starbucks, the IBM, the Pfizer, these things. Because it helps bring, you know, a ray of light and clarity for a leadership team, and you know, they co-create that together. It just doesn't come from a CEO. They all have a shared agreement that this is what we're going to go do to architect and execute our transformation.
Can we dig into one of these examples, like Starbucks? What was the situation when Howard Schultz called you?
Do you want to take it? Or?
Yeah, I'm happy to take it. I mean, you know, I think
I did it this morning.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think, you know, again, to kind of essentialize it, I think the important thing to understand with our work is that it happens at different moments. So there are different kind of situations or moments that leaders or organizations find themselves in, and we don't just work around one kind of moment. We work around a variety of kind of moments because we intersect with organizations through a variety of opportunities. Sometimes it's a relationship or a referral, or you know, a happenstance meeting, and the moment can be very different. In the Starbucks case, the moment was, it was really a moment of returning an icon to greatness, to its original greatness, but in a new way, in a relevant way to the time, in the relevant way to the business context and the context that it was in as an organization. And I think the other really interesting thing about that was, if the moment is about returning to greatness, the other really very fundamental distinguishing factor to this project was that it was a founder-led organization, founder-founded and founder-led, or at the time not founder-led, but then the moment when Howard reconnected, Howard Schultz reconnected with the company, he sort of almost refounded it in a way. Like, he came back as the founder with a deep sense and knowledge of what he had conceived and what it was originally intended to be. And that moment of, how do I bring it back to and forward, back to an alignment with what I have intended it to be, and then how do I build it future worthy? That was the moment of the work, and that's really when we came in to help in that process. And it's you know, I think what's really key to understand also, and I think this is an important thing to understand, is that we're not the answer giver. We don't provide the solution. That's not our job.
Facilitator,
we create the conditions and the partnership, and the push, and the we create the space for a leader and a leadership team to do the work of great change. And that does not mean we don't share what we believe and we don't bring point of view. Yes, we do. That does not mean that we do not have a sense of what might be sensible or right. But it does mean that we get out of the way when we need to. And it does mean that we begin from a place of having a deep belief that the company, the leader, knows better than we do their business, mm-hmm. what they do.
And it's, to get it right, it's not the typical agency takes a brief, went back, two weeks later, not so good, 2 weeks in. It's more a co-creation approach?
It's a co-creation, and it's moments of being very, very in it together. It's moments of knowing when to step back. It's moments of knowing when to have the hard conversation. It's a mixture of those, but really I always think of it as we create a space. It's not a physical space, although physical space often features, but you create a space, ongoing space for this kind of change to happen. And it's both a very personal journey for everybody involved, and then there is also a higher order journey that's also part of it.
I used to joke, you know, in many ways we're existential detectives if we're
really nice getting putting it.
Yeah, really getting underneath to unpack the hardcore why. And often we play the role of therapist, you know, for leadership teams to, you know, often, you know, and Starbucks is a great example, just with, you know, with Howard coming for returning to the helm in 2008 in the midst of the Great Recession. We all know how expensive coffees were, and people are saving, and he has to make a case that you want to spend $4.50, $5-$6 for a cappuccino. Difficult challenge. And you know, as Thomas was alluding to, you know the founder or the core idea of Starbucks has always been about this notion of the third place. You know, you have your work, you have your home, you have a Starbucks. And this was not radical in a way, but you know, through massive growth, especially while Howard had stepped away, you know, Starbucks had really lost its way. You know, I think Howard described it as fighting for the soul of the company, need to rediscover its soul again. And at the moment when we engaged him, you know, he returned to the helm, and he had almost like three choices about what to do with the company. You know, it had increasingly commoditized the experience, so you know, they could choose to be almost like a more fast food chain if they wanted to, and they could probably be a very, very good one if they wanted that. Another one is that, you know, they have also invested in so many brilliant locations across the world. They're everywhere. It could be a fantastic real estate company, you know. And the third is really this idea of, well, what would it look like to really recommit to the third place again, to really, you know, inspire people when they come into to the coffee shop, reintroduce people to coffee, and make it more of a, you know, place a stake in the heart of a community. And you know, if they were to really unlock that, that could be really fantastic. And to do that, obviously, I think we would all agree that the third choice is the obvious one for bold and brave leaders. But to do
and a
that,
sustainable one,
yeah, for sure. But to do that, you know, we had to build belief first for a fractured leadership team that they could transform themselves again. And you know, part of that required engineering an epiphany for them that real icons are in a constant state of transformation, in a way of breaking new ground. It's not a one and done. And for Starbucks to be iconic and truly iconic, would have to not just transform itself once, but prepare themselves and create the right conditions so that they can continuously transform over and over again.
Reconnecting at all times to the core founding idea, even if constant transformation means bringing it into modernity and reimagining it for a changing world. But there was a really important piece in this, which was this idea of human connection and coffee being a facilitator of that, and the importance of human connection and community in the space and the place where people come together. And that is, I think, the universal guiding thought that was a founding idea, and that didn't go away. I think what really was the challenge was to go, we can reinvent, and we all are part of that reinvention, and it's possible, and it's about being iconic again. And that was actually the beginning of the work.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that you not just deliver a new manifesto or whatever, you really bring the people together, yes, who then should translate this for their customers. So you bring, in the Starbucks case, you bring thousands of people together.
Yeah, it's part of our kind of our theory of change. You know, of course, it doesn't always work this way. But if we were to think about it sequentially, for example, you know, first it's crafting, you know, clarified purpose, crafting a powerful vision worth fighting for, aligning the leadership team behind it so they believe and they're ready to carry that through. But awesome leadership team aligned is great, but really next step is the culture, right? And you have to equip the people to see, feel, believe, experience the change potently.
And act on it.
Yeah. And, you know, with Starbucks is really remarkable, the bravery that Howard had, because he knew that if they were really to be about the third place and reinvent the experience in store to be more customer-centric, more community-based, more human, the executives aren't the ones who are going to drive that change. It's going to be the store managers. And they're the ones who control the experience of the store. It sounds obvious then, but it's not really... sounds obvious now, wasn't so much then. But Howard firmly believed that the root of the change belongs with the store managers. And so he did the incredible thing of he closed stores and shipped all 10,000 store managers to New Orleans for almost, I think, a 3-5 day experience, where he really inculcated them in the power of coffee, in the power of community, in the power of the third place, and the power of community. And we took them, really, all these store managers, on a journey of reconnecting them to coffee. You know, many of them, I think Howard writes this in his book, didn't realize that coffee actually comes from a plant. And you know, we created a number of immersive experiences, just to engineer that, but also really build belief that actually, you know, in a Starbucks, there are tons of great human stories happening all the time. And that your role as a store manager is to create the conditions so that people can be at their best and just have honest conversations and you know, in a place that feels comfortable and community bent.
Just want to dig in, because you mentioned one really important thing, like the root of change is with the store managers. I mean, that's why they went into this massive, you know, like 10,000. I mean, that's an amazing big amount of of people. But let's dissect it for a bit. So Howard Schultz was really, really in the core of it. So we have one level, which is top management, really like top So is that kind of like a prerequisite of your work that you basically sit down and say like, we need you every week for a day or for 2 days or for a week, or how is that working? And then it's the extended leadership and then it's the store manager. So I hear those three spheres you have.
And I would add one more, and then it's the front lines. So you know, we engage at all levels of the organization, and you know, typically we do start, you know, we do believe that change kind of has to start from the top. You know, if you're a manager, you don't see your leader modeling a change, or that they don't believe it, all falls down. You know, I think that's clear. So it's natural for us to start there. And yeah, with Howard and his leadership team, it was, you know, and each client, of course, is different, but it's, I would say we work towards big convenings and moments, summits, if you might call them, to really explore and align around the direction of the company, you know, and first often it starts with an exploration around the world and what's happening, et cetera. And the second then is translates to, well, what do we believe will be true? And landing on some core beliefs for the organization, which they can then build a strategy around.
Yes. And then there's the question of, well, who were we always and why are we, you know, why are we in the world? What would the world be missing if we weren't around? It's a big question, I think, that we like to investigate at length with leadership teams, but also everybody who works in a company. It's like, okay, what is the real asset that you have in the bank that is both your soul and your purpose and your. So I think there is that. I also just want to draw a connection between, you know, I've encountered several projects where this combination of operating both in the C-suite, terrible word really, but you know, the C-suite and in the front lines with people who are right out there delivering the promise of an organization every day in micro moments and actions, who often also do not feel as valued and remunerated and privileged as some people, you know, that sit in the middle or the heart of leadership. And, you know, hospitality companies are great examples of that. And, you know, I have one example of a hospitality client where we really, really, really had to come at it from both ends at the same time, because it wasn't just about headquarters. It wasn't just about the executives in headquarters who, by the way, which was the wonderful part about that, all came through the ranks within the hotel company, which means that they understood the business, which is not always true in the C-suite of an organization. But nonetheless, they were perceived largely as sitting in an ivory tower and not being connected to the daily plight of what it means to clean rooms in not so great properties. Some of them were better than others, etc. So the work we had to do, the empathy work, and the investigation we had to do into the lived experience of the chambermaid, you know, of the room service people in different cultures, and how that the idea of a corporate purpose would be perceived at that end of an organization, or not perceived, or not cared about, and how do you design for change across the whole system? I think what your question provokes in me is to bring us back to not a method, but a belief that we have, that you have to look at the system. So the human system, from the individual, that end of the organization or this part, and then at the heart, leadership of the organization and everything in between, and then what happens when people are work as groups, teams, you know, the whole culture, and then also the impact of the organization and society at large. It's a systems diagram, really. It's not really a method of change. It's just a way of looking at the world.
Gleich geht's weiter. Ganz kurze Werbeunterbrechung. Es geht um das Blackboard Bootcamp. Wir haben jetzt wirklich nur noch wenige Wochen Zeit, bis es losgeht. Die letzten Plätze gibt es noch, nur noch ein ganz paar. Denn beim Blackboard Bootcamp geht's darum, dass wir in 2 Tagen alles das erarbeiten, was ihr im Unternehmen braucht, um New Work und Digitalprojekte voranzutreiben. Die sind häufig nämlich wirklich zerstreut. Manchmal in der IT, manchmal HR, manchmal im Change Management. Und bei uns geht es im Kern darum, wie wollen wir in Zukunft zusammenarbeiten? Wie sorgen wir dafür, dass die operativen Prozesse aus einem Guss kommen? Alles, was es dazu braucht, machen wir im Blackboard Bootcamp über Tools, über Kultur, über People, über Workspace. Es gibt Impulse, unter anderem von Michael und mir. Es gibt Workshops. Wir sind in 2 sehr coolen Locations von unseren Partnern Design Offices und Vitra. Also es lohnt sich, da mal reinzuschauen. Es gibt sehr viel Informationen dazu auf der Seite blackboat.com/bootcamp. Guckt rein, sehr viel von den Podcast-Zuhörern sind schon angemeldet, also insofern auch mal eine Gelegenheit, sich zu treffen. Und jetzt viel Spaß mit der Folge.
You mentioned that you very often stay for a long period of the time with a CEO. No? So, for instance, Starbucks, there's not just this big project, there are other situations where they ask you to support them. You have clients since, some of your clients, 10, 15 years or...?
Yeah, and we have 15-year clients. We have, but I would even say we have clients that probably, in some strange way, span the entire 25 years of our existence. Because one thing I think we didn't maybe mention that I always found a very compelling insight that I think Susan once shared with me, our CEO, in a conversation, or maybe she shared it with the company. But I just remember that there was an early belief that emerged in the early years of the organization, that there is people out there that have high potential to be leaders that will have impact in the world. And actually, a strategic move that I think shaped the company we are today was that there was this, our founders saw that there are certain people that we need to help become great because they have it and they're going to bring great things to the world. And they were business leaders in the making that we put belief in and became partners to. And I really like this idea because if I think about it, it actually holds true to this day in the kind of network and family of people we've built and the careers that, I mean, I wouldn't be as presumptuous to say we've built or made careers, but we've certainly have been partners in leadership journeys of several chapters in people. And so they in turn have been generous, vice versa. And I think that's really where we are today. But it was this belief that there are leaders there. It's not so much about communications and helping companies with brands and whatever. It was more about there's certain. It's all about people that will be or are beginning to have impact in the landscape of business and society and culture. And let's be with them. Let's make a company that can be there for them and help them.
A lot of companies say this, but I mean, we have a deep, deep relationship, Ben. No. Like we really. You know, we really believe that when we find a kindred spirit, we want to grow with them and help them be at their best. And so, over 25 years, we've seen leaders, and it's funny, we're working with one now, you know, who brought us in very early into, say, IBM, and then, you know, before now, we're in eBay, and where we are now, which, it's a really nice and remarkable bent because, you know, it's almost like and you've seen when you visit our office, it's like a family, you know, you come in, you sit at the table and that's, and we figure out how we can be most helpful.
Let's talk a little bit about your office. Max was so kind to introduce me to you guys. I had the chance to meet you there. What is the philosophy behind your own office? Why does it look like it looks? And how does it look?
Because yeah.
We're in a podcast, we have to.
It's an intro. Well, again, I think.
The table is one thing.
Yeah, well, describe it, Max. What was your impression when you walked in?
Yeah, and Michael asked me earlier on how we met. So funny enough that you ask, it was actually because of your office, but also about like shared beliefs. So actually, the introduction comes through a mutual friend. And it was one of those introductions like, look, Max, don't ask, visit them. They're awesome. So that was
the first thing. Michael, don't ask, visit them.
That's true. I made the same introduction to you because how would you put it into words? But what I experienced visiting you guys for the first time was this kind of family spirit. You have, of course, the big, big, big table. It's probably the longest table I've ever seen. And it really has this family feeling, I think, for someone, you know, it's not the usual office thing where people look busy, so don't get me wrong. It was not like that people were hanging out and like, I don't know, playing ping pong and watching TV. It was definitely an office, so it was definitely a work atmosphere. But in this kind of conversational way, so people were getting up the table, they were going to breakout rooms, they came back to the big table, they worked on laptops, they showed stuff, they did calls. So yeah, so for me, I thought it's really like this family feeling, like this very co-creational. It felt like that you guys, I'm working on something very concentrated, but oh, there is someone I can grab and I can just share some some food for thought, and then I get feedback, and then let's go quickly to a breakout room. And it felt like this back and forth between concentration, open co-creation, brainstorming.
I think it's interesting what you're saying. I think you've basically created the sort of the brief that went to the architects, but it was also a very collaborative effort in making it. And I remember actually, I'll be very honest about this, I was a skeptic of the office at first, and I realized that I needed to inhabit it for a while and to understand the intention of it. And you mentioned it very well, and I'll just draw an abstract, which is, it's really about modes of working. We work in different modes at different times, in different ways, around different problems, and respecting and understanding that modes of working really require different constellations and spaces, right, was really at the heart of the how this space was conceived. And it was actually a you know, for me certainly, coming from a space that was more tightly packed and more collegial and more high pressure, going to a place that was so sprawling and large. It's a bit like going from Manhattan to Berlin, actually. Like, the going into the new office felt like these large avenues and parks with three people in it. And, you know, in Manhattan, it's like parks with a million people in it. So I actually like quite enjoyed the pressure cooker atmosphere and the closeness. And then it took me a while to switch. And we all, I think, were finding the space first for ourselves. Like, oh my, I can't see my colleagues for a whole day. Where have they gone, etc. Anyway, so all that to say is that now it's growing on us that we've been in it for, you know, a year and actually 2 years now. It's starting to happen. You know, people are inhabiting the space in accordance with the needs of their work process and their social needs, and it's also just wonderfully designed with a wonderful level of empathy for just basic things. Like, if you want to run to work, I'm one of those people, and you want to have a shower, you can, and there's a beautiful shower. There is a meditation room for people who need to chill during the day. You know, some people don't need to chill, some people do, but it's just built with us in mind.
And for your listeners who just need more visual kind of piece, I think there are three things I would just kind of call out that I really love. And yeah, one, of course, is, you know, we have this cafe space that's kind of punctuated by this giant table cut from, I think, a single tree, which is meant to, you know, we hold many convenings around there for clients, workstations, etc. And it's a great warm feeling. As a matter of fact, it's a funny anecdote. When you walked into SY Partners, we didn't have a reception area. We just had the table. And with the attention that you would walk in and just sit at a table, et cetera. And, you know, we loved it, very optimistic that people would figure it out. And unfortunately, you know, despite best intentions, we've had a lot of confused clients saying, where am I? So we have a little reception there now. And I think, you know, the other thing to point out is additional workspaces. We have this great lab space. And actually, that's part of the reason why we've chosen this location. You know, for those in New York, it's very hard to find a building in New York that doesn't have kind of columns that goes through them. So, you know, we found a space that is, what would you say, like 30 square meters by...
Yeah, it's like a small theater.
Yeah,
the size of a small theater stage.
Right.
So it can fit, you know,
and
a decent amount of people.
Our clients love that because you can walk in there and you know, it's really like a blank slate that we can easily transform and to create something new and powerful and immersive. And so.
But that's where you run co-creation sessions.
Exactly.
For instance, and you use the walls and.
Totally, and you know, we can bring the full power of our design and creativity to life for leaders who are really evaluating their future. And they, you know, so much of it is about, you have to touch it.
To inhabit it.
Yeah. And so that's a great space that does that. And I'd say the third real move, and you know, when you guys know, when you walk around, we have a bunch of what we call pods, little workspaces that are modular that we can expand and grow depending on the size of the engagement. But we have what we call a maker space, which is almost smack right in the middle of where we structure our pods, our working pods. And that's a very intentional move because we love the art of prototyping and quickly making and testing things and see how quickly we can bring an exercise or an experience to life. And the just deliberate move of having that right in the center of our office really, you know,
encourages the mode.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's funny, if you went to our old office, it used to be in the back. and you would never really see it, and said, actually, no, we need to bring it forward and you know, make sure it's very much both figuratively and physically the center of gravity of the firm.
Let's just switch over to one other project we talked about earlier in the morning. So one part for Christoph and me for our podcast learning thing is that education, school system, and so on has to change. And when I visited you in New York, you showed me a project done by Lorraine Powell Jobs, who is very much engaged into the education system, and I was really, really fascinated. Maybe you can talk a little bit about this.
Yeah, no, we should both talk about it. I mean, I think, again, to try to bring it to the point, there was an opportunity that obviously she was pursuing in alignment with her focus. I mean, she's clearly very engaged with the transformation and improvement of the high school, American high school experience. And with the means available to her foundation and driven by her belief that that change needs to happen, we engaged with her in a project that was already somewhat underway, but needed, you know, architecting and clarity and then also making real. And really what it is a nationwide competition. And that's really at the high level, a nationwide competition that would engage people involved in the high school experience, from educators to students, and allowing groups of people to congregate and design new ideas for how a high school can be. Envision a new high school system, an improved high school system, and then design it. And then prototype it and try it out in the real world. That's something that's possible in a country where there is no national curriculum per se. It's also possible in a country where, you know, the connection between private funding and education and, you know, these kind of initiatives can freely unfold. So it was really about like democratizing the possibility of designing the way forward. It's a huge challenge that essentially the project became around how do you take the design process and the imagination process that can happen, you know, that we practice every day in our and in your company as well, right? Like, and in yours with people that, you know, are trained designers and in a controlled environment, and how do you take that into the world, give it as a gift to groups of people disparately scattered across the country, and giving them the tools so they can actually do the work of imagining and designing a prototype. And that was one of the big, and then it was connected, of course, to a competition where the best idea would then be funded and made real. But the process to that was a process of first, you know, getting people enrolled, getting the toolkit out to people and giving them the resources that they would need. Not just the actual toolkit of how to design a high school, which in and of itself sounds like a gargantuan challenge, but it's quite a beautiful piece, but also all the resource material and the information and the kind of access to expert opinion to actually understand the landscape of American high school. So we co-created with our client and a lot of other partners a kind of resource, as well as a design toolkit, as well as a program or calendar that would lead to the competition.
And I think, you know, it really was about launching a movement, I think, across the country. And I think what's really different about our approach was, you know, traditionally, you know, people were inclined to just throw money at a problem. And I think for those of you listeners might know that, you know, for example, like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook invested heavily in Newark trying to fix the public school system. I think $1 billion went into it. It's a remarkable gift. And if you followed, it wasn't very successful. It was just put in the hands of those who aren't actually in the trenches every day making decisions. And that, I think, you know, with Lorraine, you know, creating the foundation of this movement to involve students, principals, teachers every day to rethink, what are you experiencing? What would be better? What needs to be redesigned? And
it's the equivalent to the store manager.
It's exactly.
It's the people on the ground working daily.
Who control the experience. It's exactly right. And, you know, so it manifested itself, yes, in toolkits, and that, you know, if you signed up for this competition, you received one. And by the way, it was quite rigorous. We didn't send it to everyone. And we also, to launch this movement, there was also a nationwide campaign, you know, in many public cities, in San Francisco and in New York. We wanted to hear from students. We captured their stories. The governor of New York was involved, and eventually, you know, this kid made it all the way up to President Obama, which is quite amazing, and getting his endorsement to launch it. And so where we are now is a number of these big ideas are actually being funded very powerfully through Lorraine. I think we had a nationwide campaign, and actually I think
there was also the big TV show.
Yeah.
That was the sort of first big award that, you know, that actually gave the award to the best idea and then the funds, and then sort of kicked off the first realizations of this.
So the end goal is then that other high schools look at the results and
that's
say,
right.
Wow, this
correct.
Is so cool, I can...
Exactly.
And yeah. So it's still ongoing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. We're right. Prototyping ideas and, you know, scaling what works, right?
Wow. Yeah, we have it's time flies, but I have two more things. You had a very nice present to the guests of Max breakfast. By the way, it was fantastic breakfast. Thank you for having us.
It's
a really
welcome.
Good thank idea. You. I will steal it from you. No, I would be
no,
happy
let's
to,
do it more together.
To be invited also, yeah. And your gift was a card game with one question. The question says, what's your superpower? Mm-hmm. Explain how we use this. And then... explain what is your superpower, and we can think about ours.
So, you know, it's funny. We, at SY Partners, we often look about really concerned both at the individual level and in a team setting, really helping understand what do people need to be at the very best, and also understand what do people uniquely bring to the table, especially in the sense of a team setting. And so these cards, which you see here, are meant to unlock for the individual to help them understand, well, what do they uniquely bring in a team setting? And, you know, it's an exercise to help, it's almost prioritize, you know. So you go through, may I see one card here? So for example, I'm looking at a card that says experimentation. And in the back they say, well, what is your superpower? And we have a context here. So for example, the team is hesitating. They're worrying about what they don't know and trying to plan everything in advance. They need to stop overthinking things and just start making stuff, putting it out there and learning as they go, which is why they need you as an experimenter. And that's the unique thing that you're going to bring to the table. So,
and you work your way through the deck by a process of elimination. So you always take two cards and then which one is more you, this one or that
cool.
one? And you throw the one that is less you until you end up with one card.
Ah, well, yeah.
That's how you get to the...
And people absolutely love them. And, you know, we actually, as a ritual internally, we perform this with our own teams as we do on projects, because it's important to know what are the different strengths that we each bring and how to play to them.
Yeah.
And also, frankly, be aware sometimes of the shadow side of leaning into your superpower too much.
Yeah.
And so your teammates can call you out. So, for example, if you're a deep optimist, sometimes you ignore reality. If you've got too much energy, for example, you can overpower a team, and helping people be aware of that is another big piece.
I think I found mine, actually.
Oh, yeah?
That was pretty straightforward. So creative thinking, it says, this team keeps going down a well-worn path. They want to break out and try new things, but gravity pulls them toward what's familiar. No matter how or where they start, they end up someplace they've been before. Mm. They need a fresh approach, which is why they need you. And I have to say, that's probably my secret superpower, because throughout my career, I mean, no matter the task, no matter the industry, no matter how late at night it is, there is some creative spark that comes up. And so...
I'm still, I don't...
you have too many superpowers.
No, I don't have... I'm switching between vision and ingenuity. I was looking for inspiration, but there's no inspiration card, but I think the mixture... maybe I have to sleep one night. And I learned... Mark, you are...
Energy.
Energy, yeah.
Yes.
Is that you?
Yeah, I mean, I think my...
So true?
Really? Yes.
So. I'll read the back of it. So, you know, the team lacks oomph. They're each a little drained. They need a burst of force to get things humming again. They need an injection of enthusiasm, vibrancy, and playfulness. And I think my metabolism is known, renowned across the firm.
Yes. I can, yeah. I can...
yeah, read yours.
I can definitely put evidence to that. Mine is provocation. This team comes to conclusions too easily. There's no friction and too much consensus. They need to be pushed out of their comfort zone. They need someone who can shake things up and challenge them, which is why they need you.
Very good. So I will take one more night, but it's lovely. So last thing we're asking our guests is, where do you get your inspiration from? What kind of books did you read? Is there any book we would recommend to them? Michael, you have to read this book, then you understand me much better, or where do you get inspiration?
Wow, that's a big question because it's...
One is New York, apparently. Because walking through New York, it's hard to not be inspired.
that's true.
I think it's a really big question. I wouldn't put it down to one book. I mean, as I think I started, you know, my story with a little bit is, I think I get my inspiration not so much from books, although that might come sometimes. I think I get it from situations that overwhelm me in some way, whether they're emotional or they're visual, and spending time in that moment to allow that feeling to convey and to understand its mechanism and why it is the way it is. And I think I think it comes from many, many different places. And if I would put my job down to like one thing that I really try to do every day and have to do every day, is to encourage others to go deep on things, see something, spend time with it. Whether it's something inside of yourself or something that you've just experienced doesn't really matter. It's to connect with the thing you're feeling. And what is it? Why is it important? Why does it matter? That's, I think, where inspiration comes from, is to open that aperture constantly. Like, go look at places that maybe you tell yourself are not interesting to you. So, you know, I think that's where it comes from.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's, you know, in the coffee shops and in the bars and the hotel lounges all over the world. And, you know, I'm hunger for different perspectives. I think they fuel me, and learning how different people see different problems and with different points of view and reconciling them, I think gives me so much energy and it's something I always hunger for. So especially actually here in Berlin, I have to say, where the ideas are so rampant in each corner, it's, you know, I could spend, I think, a good month here, 2 months, years even, probably, drawing inspiration from what lie in the corners. And New York, to your point, is masterful at that. Yeah, daily inspiration.
Very nice. So absolutely, last question. What are you doing the next days in Germany? Why are you here? What is your purpose for your trip?
Yeah, we've even been talking with each other and sharing, you know, what is a motivator. I mean, it's been certainly something we've been fantasizing about and now making real. So I'll tell you what I think for me is the really interesting thing. And it gets back to the notion of universality, which is, you know, I'm half German. I understand also as a European who moved to America, and it's really the only way to start to hold two, in some ways, contradicting ideas inside of you and be able to live with them, that you know, America is founded on a completely different idea than many of the European countries and maybe even Europe as a whole. And I'm not going to go into what that is, because we all sort of know it, but I think the source code of these nations and cultures influences how the entire society and business and everything else expresses itself every day. And I think you have to actually connect to, tap into, and live in another paradigm in order to understand where you came from. And so for me, the number one compelling drawing thing is that I think what we do and how we think about transformation is truly universal. I don't think this is cultural. I think that where we do it and how we do it has cultural idiosyncrasy, but I'm curious to understand where the commonalities are in a culture and a paradigm that is fundamentally different from where I live now, but that is familiar to who I am. And I think, you know, Mark will probably speak also about the moment.
Everything you said, and, you know, I'm in Germany, let's say, 3-4 times a year, often having conversations, and, you know, I have to say, I've seen a kind of inflection point, and in Germany, at least among my friends, where suddenly the conversations that felt so alien, let's say 10 years ago, how we think are now seem commonplace. And you see real connective tissue, and I find more kindred spirits here. And so, you know, what we're doing, to answer your question more on the point, is, you know, we're here meeting a number of different organizations, a lot of different leaders, to really share what we know about transformation. We've been around it for 25 years. I loved your point. It's a very universal practice. It's something we really hold true and believe. And, you know, we're eager to share what we know and understand how we might be helpful to a country and a culture that we really hold dear to our hearts.
And I will just add that one, which is, I think, historically, it has iconic organizations, just like America does, for-profit and not-for-profit. And
iconic people.
And iconic people. That's for sure.
Cool. So, thank you guys.
Thank you very much. No,
thank you.
Thank you.
Hope to see you again very soon.
It was a real pleasure. Cheers.
Thank you.